This podcast is supported by JBS International Incorporated through a grant award from the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, with 0% finance with non-governmental sources. The contents are those of the author and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement, by HRSA, HHS, or the U.S. government. For more information, please visit HRSA.gov.
Welcome into another episode of Rural Roads, the Hardcore Podcast, where we discuss the stories, individuals, and everything else within the rural community's opioid response program. I'm your host, Tim Raybould with JBS International. Before we get into it, just a quick reminder on some of the ways you could stay connected and informed of all the latest Hardcore information, updates, resources, and more. As always, you can visit the Hardcore TA portal, check out the new modules on the LMS, and keep up with the monthly newsletter and weekly roundup emails. You can also follow us on social media by liking Hardcore TA News on Facebook and following Hardcore TA on both Twitter and Instagram.
Welcome into another episode of Rural Roads, the Hardcore Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Raybould with JBS International, and today is our Season 1 finale. For those who have been listening since February, that's pretty remarkable, and we really do appreciate it. We hope the content has been helpful over the course of the year. This episode's a little different. We wanted to capture the evolution of Hardcore in a few different ways. Over the past 5 years, over the past year, hearing from a grantee directly who was there from the start, a lot of different perspectives. Shamelessly, I'm going to start with the podcast itself, and for the record, I was asked to give its brief history. It came about as this idea back in the summer of 2022, when we're evaluating all the different ways we communicate with grantees, and the idea actually came about on around how to get some of the information and different things that are happening within Hardcore and capture that content and distribute it to grantees in ways that we weren't already doing. And so things like social media came about, and the podcast was born out of that discussion as well. The thought was if we could get some of these conversations that were already happening, whether it was at the RSV or on monthly calls or elsewhere, turn it into an audio-only format and be able to easily distribute that for grantees to listen to, whether y'all are driving or doing something at home or just put it on in the background or while you're exercising, any kind of way that folks are typically listening to podcasts, and it could be beneficial. And I think we've seen that over the course of the year as the downloads and plays have just increased month to month. And it's been great to see that kind of engagement with this kind of first launch of something like this. So we started out with these pilot episodes and tried to build it out internally, wanting to get it out to grantees soon, but also wanting to have some kind of product that we put time and effort into and curated in a way that was going to be impactful and receptive by the grantees and by all the different Hardcore stakeholders. And now looking back, season one, we have almost 40 episodes that we put out there. We've got nearly that planned for season two already. This year, we accumulated about 2,500 plays and downloads throughout the calendar year since our launch in early February. We've had 7 different hosts. A lot of the different tells on GBS have stepped up to guest host or co-host, and about 50 different guests, grantees, outside folks, different individuals at GBS. We've had quite the variety. And looking ahead to season two, we're aiming to have more targeted content, look at some of the different TA needs that are being identified and curate episodes based on that. More episodes than season one, explore different styles and structures and really try and make this something that sticks around and is a really helpful TA compliment to you all as you're doing your work in rural communities across the country. Hardcore, I'll say this probably 3 different times at least over the course of the episode, but it's a remarkable program. There's over 375 grantees in 46 different states, almost covers the whole country. To have about 400 grantees is just an incredible investment in this work by HRSA. We've had about 3,000 TA requests just in calendar year 2023. And at this past year's RSV, had over 750 grantees attend. I will always remember being in that room when all the hands were raised for the first time at the RSV, first time in DC, and seeing all the different connections that were made. And I know the Save the Date recently went out for our new dates in March, and to get everyone back together will be just a wonderful time. There's so much to dive into. Fortunately, We have a lot of people to choose from to help tell that story. And we're now going to hear from ArcCore TA's co-project directors to learn a little bit more. Let's listen in. All right, we're joined now by John Roberts and Alicia Figueroa, our co-project directors of ArcCore. And surprisingly, the first time we've had both of them on the podcast. So really appreciate you both. Well, yeah, it's great to have you on. As I mentioned to you both before, this episode's packed with a lot of different directions. A year in review of the season, the first season of the podcast, kind of capturing some of the impact and power of ArcCore, some of the history and a bunch of different parts. So who better to have on than both of you? So I wanted to actually start with kind of your ArcCore story, if you will. And Alicia, maybe you can start and I'll come to you, John. But catching folks up who are listening on how you came to GBS, what your first kind of intersection was with ArcCore, and then how it got to the role you have today and what that looks like. Yeah, I'll turn it over to you, Alicia.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So it's fun because I started my career as a project director of a community coalition, doing work in the community on the ground. And so ArcCore is near and dear to my heart because I feel like it's work that I'm familiar with and I know how tough it is. And so I'm really happy to be there to be a support. I then went on to the state level and I worked for the Office of Drug Policy for the state of Idaho. I was the governor's drug policy advisor. And in that role, I received TA from JBS. So I got to know folks at JBS pretty well at that point. And when they had an opening, they recruited me over. And so I joined on a different project. But about a year into my work at JBS, we won the ArcCore Cooperative Agreement. And so I moved over. So I've been with ArcCore from the very beginning, the first day. And it has been really a pretty special experience to watch the growth. I've also had the opportunity to work as a technical expert lead, as a cohort lead, as a deputy project director, and now as a co-project director. So I feel like I've worked in a lot of the different roles on the team, which I think is a real benefit as well.
Oh, absolutely. Do you feel like it's taken almost like different parts of your brain? Like when you were telling, you could just, I was focused on the grantees and other kind of requirements within ArcCore TA versus now there's so many different kind of layers to it. Does it feel like you've had difference?
Yeah, sure. It's required a lot of growth because I relied heavily on the experience and the knowledge that I had gained at the community level when I was a TEL. I felt like I could really relate to grantees and what they were experiencing and hear the needs that they had and hopefully try to fulfill those. I knew what was helpful to me as a TA recipient and what was a waste of my time. So I used that. And now that my role is strictly administrative, it's very different. You don't get the same kind of, adrenaline bump or excitement that you get dealing with folks in communities every day. But it's rewarding in other ways.
Yeah, thank you for that. And John, you were obviously also there at those early days. How would you guys describe your kind of story and especially anything notable about those early days of ArcCore?
Sure. Yeah, I came to JBS in 2014 and I had worked previously for about 30 years as a provider and administrator in different healthcare settings. I worked outpatient, hospital settings, long-term residential, worked in jails, drug courts, worked in foster care for a while, pretty broad-based there, worked in primary care also. And in those different systems. And like Alicia, I've also been a project director for federal grants on the other side of it, where you have that moment where, hey, we just won this grant. This is great. And, this looks like a lot of work. So I know that feeling too, when you're just thrilled that you're won and you're going to help your community. But you also know that I already have a full-time job and this is a lot to do. And we got to get going really quick. So I'm familiar with that feeling of elation and then realizing how much work this is going to be. And I know that's how some of our grantees have felt too, as they've gotten started. And when I came to JBS in 2014, I started as a technical expert lead, which is basically our term for subject matter expert, and worked with grantees across the country who were setting up programs for SUD treatment for adolescents and what we call transition age youth, 18 to 21, and then up to 26 in some settings where they were a lot of times had been in the foster care system and were trying to keep stable and keep going in really difficult situations. So I worked on that. And then I went to the state what we call the State TA Project, which was working with a behavioral health system, state behavioral health systems across states and territories. And that's where I first ran into Alicia. Actually, back in the pre-Zoom days, I had never met Alicia because she's in Idaho and I'm in Virginia and our office is in Maryland. And I just happened to be walking down the hall one day at JBS, I think around 2017, and I heard a voice that sounded familiar because we didn't have Zoom. We just had conference lines and I didn't know what anybody looked like because we had staff all over the country. And I said, that voice sounds familiar. So I introduced myself and that's how we met. And then we both came to this project and it's just having Alicia as a co-project director. It's just wonderful. It's been great. And we're having a great time. So I think that it's we got off to a great start. As far as you asked about the beginning of ARCOR, and back then, it was 2018 when we got started, we had, I think, 5 project officers on the HRSA side, and we had a couple of more TELs, I think up to 8, but a lot of them were part-time because we had just won the award and we were trying to piece together how we were going to do this. And it was a total of 95 grantees, and they were all what we call now Planning One. We started having attached Roman numerals as this thing got bigger and bigger, but it was a Planning One cohort, 95 grantees. And it was heavily based around thinking about what you're going to do and how you're going to provide services. It wasn't a service grant. And developmentally, a lot of federal grants start that way. They start with a planning phase and then an implementation phase after that. So that wasn't unusual. So we helped the grantees put together strategic plans. They had to put together a workforce plan, a sustainability plan, and get their consortium members together with MOUs. A lot of the work at the beginning was planning oriented and helping the grantees figure out what they were going to do when they got to that level of providing services. And that's how we started. And from there now, it's 377 grantees and a whole lot more staff on HRSA side and on our side.
Great. Thanks, John. I was going to bring up, too, the way you two serve as co-project directors. I think it's really remarkable. I think there's been movies and shows and stuff where they almost like make fun of the situations where there has to be like 2 managers or 2 principals or 2, and it doesn't work, and it like ends up being a whole, you know, comedy skit. There were like one-off jokes of look at all the great countries with 2 presidents, that kind of stuff. But I'm wondering how you two have gone about, I don't want to say divide and conquer because that sounds pretty like hierarchical, but you've created really good synergy and put together a really good team and clearly have to separate out different tasks, big and small. How have you both kind of approached that?
Gosh, I think we've worked together for a number of years before we became co-project directors. Mm-hmm. So we've, you know, gotten to know each other and we have different backgrounds and different subject matter expertise, but we have the same thoughts and the same approach to this project and what it means to be successful. And so it just seems to work really well. I don't know I think we just maybe got really lucky.
What do they say about luck? It's like opportunity meets preparation.
Yeah.
That probably fits. Anything else you wanted to add about it, John?
I just think the same thing. I think we worked together on different projects for years. We started on ARCOR as TELs, and then we became cohort leads, and then we became deputy project directors, and then we became project directors along the same trajectory and at the same time. So we were learning it all at the same time. And it's great to have a resource when you think about being a leader of a large project like this with a whole bunch of staff, and to have somebody else at your level that's a colleague that you can just go to and say, what do you think about this? I think it's a great advantage. And I'm grateful that it's set up the way it's set up.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I think it makes the project stronger.
Yeah, we'll come back to that actually in a little bit too, because I think there's more to talk about there. I want to go over to impact, because you all have seen this from the beginning. And I remember the kind of chart we put together a year ago and has since been updated, but just some of the numbers around the impact of ARCOR, with it being in nearly every state, hundreds of grantees, maybe a couple thousand counties served at this point, thousands of TA requests. Are there any notable numbers or even memories, anything that comes to mind for either of you that captures or stands out in terms of like the power of ARCOR, the impact? Because it's a really amazing program. It touches a lot of people and saves a lot of lives. So anything that stands out for you, Alicia?
Yeah, there are a few things actually that stand out. I was looking at data the other day at a report, and since 2018, when we started, we have been able to support 856 grantees. And that's mind-blowing to me, right? That's just a huge number of communities that have benefited from our core funds and that we've been able to interact with and work with. And then when you look at the impact that they're having, which we don't take credit for, but when we see the larger impact that they've had, I pulled some numbers that for implementation cohorts 1, 2, and 3, as well as that expansion, they had screened for SUD 3.6 million people.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's like when you start talking millions of people impacted, and that's just one service. That's just screening for SUD. 3.6 million people, and that's only 4 cohorts. We have 10 cohorts now. So things like that, those are the things that give you the chills, like kind of, I don't know, make you almost choke up just a little bit, because that 3.6 million is more than just a number, right? Those are folks in our communities. But I think that the thing that really speaks the most to me is I have the benefit of getting to read comments from grantees. So TELS will often share feedback that they've received from the grantees that they're working with. And just hearing that the TA is, that the relationships are good and strong and that they're having their needs met, that's, I feel like, the most rewarding thing about this project is just hearing that what we're doing and what we're working so hard on is really helpful. I love that.
Thanks for that. And John, same question to you.
Yeah, I think when I talked earlier about the beginning of the R-Corps story, we had talked about starting with 95 planning grantees, and I have to give credit to her here for being so responsive to the grantee needs that we've branched out from there into all these various cohorts that are targeted to specific needs. We have a psychostimulant support cohort, which addresses issues with those substances. We have a neonatal abstinence syndrome. We've had 2 cohorts there. We have behavioral health support, when grantees had talked about some of the missing connections between behavioral health systems. We've had the MAD access. We have overdose response now. We have a child and adolescent in response to all the things that are going on with service shortages in those areas. So again, I have to give credit to HRSA for listening to the grantees and them saying, yes, this is an opioid use disorder based program at the beginning. It's opioid response is the name of it. But some of the things that have come into play that are also struggles in their community are things that HRSA has really reached out and responded to. To me, that's a big impact. Again, as I mentioned, a lot of federal grants start with a planning phase, move into implementation, and that's where it stops. But for HRSA to really custom design these to the needs of grantees all across the country is a huge advantage for this project. And Alicia mentioned, we do this with partners, and we work with HRSA as a partner. We're the TA provider. In looking at some of the numbers too, I know that we get thousands of TA requests every year, over 6,000 last year alone. And to me, that also talks about that the grantees do trust us and do come back to us because we're giving something that's of value to them, which is helping them as they get their projects going and maintaining their projects. So just the fact that they can come to us and say, this has really been helpful, is really important. As far as some of the, Alicia mentioned the services provided, and I don't want to go over that again, but when we're talking about something that's reaching millions of people, I think you can't emphasize that enough. The other side of that is to reach all those people, you have to increase workforce. And we have, obviously, HRSA has evaluators that take a look at the work that we're doing as TA providers and also the impact of the project. So they've been able to pull some numbers that just show a 5-fold increase in the number of providers who are treating SUD within our core service areas. So that's since the beginning of the R Core project in 2018. And that 88% of the service areas have peer support specialists working on SUD issues in their communities, which to me is a huge thing, just the advantage of peer support and people who've been through that helping out and also bolstering the workforce is makes a huge difference. The other thing I want to mention, and I know it's a growing area, is just in harm reduction, that 87% of the harm reduction sites in our core service areas are offering naloxone now and teaching about naloxone administration. To me, that's huge. The last thing I'll say, because I know this is a lot of numbers, but impact is impact. And we talk about having over 4,000 agencies across the country involved in our core consortiums. And that's a huge increase. And when you think about the multidisciplinary organizations that are working in this area, I think it's just great. And we know as the opioid epidemic spread initially, you would see on geographical maps, you'd see overdose areas and there'd be all these hot maps of where that was spreading. And then in opioid response program, we started putting projects and grantees into those areas to respond. And I think it's had a huge impact along the way. There are more things I could talk about, but that's a lot of numbers for now. But I think the impact over the 5 years, and 5 years is a good period of time to look at that, has just been really outstanding.
Yeah, no, a couple of things, because what I've heard a little bit in between the lines is that the impact's so large and great, you can't even capture all of it. I was on right before this, I was on a call with the grantee and the TEL doing just a bit, some TA, and they had a example, which I think is actually fairly common, where the grantee's not in the service area they're operating in, and there's this indirect exposure to a lot of folks who are from rural communities, but not in that same service area that they're working in. So there's all these other folks that are either maybe getting screened, like Alicia was talking about, or participating in some kind of service or programming, or there's some benefit, and it's not even all tracked. So it really is quite the large exposure and impact. The other thing I was thinking about, which will be a good bridge back to the other conversation we were having, is the internal kind of data gathering we did the other day, where we were looking for examples from our own folks, from TELS, on particularly noteworthy or impactful things that grantees have been able to do due to our core funding. And within a couple hours, we had, over 100 submissions, and that wasn't even go consult with your grantee. That was just stuff that folks knew. So I thought that was amazing that our team could come up with that many detailed examples in that short period of time. And the bridge there is going back to what we were talking about, you two serving as co-project directors, but the synergy and the expertise we have on the team. I feel like I can't say enough about it. Every time I'm having different folks on the podcast or working with folks from the POP or the whole RSV experience, there's a lot of different points I feel like I've been able to intersect, and we have really great people. I was wondering, either you two, maybe Alicia, we can start, just anything you can give insight wise onto the team or behind the scenes, anything along those lines.
Yeah, we do have an amazing team. Sometimes we sit together in our team meetings and it's like a whole bunch of Brady Bunch squares right on the screen, because the team is pretty large at this point. And you look around the room and you just think, oh my gosh, we've got some of the leading experts in some of these topic areas in the country, and how fortunate we are that we can offer that expertise to the grantees. And John and I, because we've been around from the beginning, we have had a part in building the team, and we have been pretty strategic about it. We sit down when we have an opening and we talk about what kind of expertise do grantees need right now. Do they need somebody that has maternal health expertise? Do they need a mental health counselor that we need to bring on board, somebody that has more expertise in psychostimulants? And so as we've had the opportunity to bring folks on, we've really been pretty strategic about it. And the idea being that we have all of these people now with deep subject matter expertise in their field. We've built this team that is just this conglomerate of all kinds of different expertise. For instance, John, he's done treatment his whole career. And if somebody is more of a primary prevention expert like I am, and they have a need for their grantee to learn more about treatment, they can bring John over on the calls. Although the TEL is the primary point of contact for each grantee and provides most of the TA, the team is built so that we can call on the expertise of all of our colleagues. And I think that's what makes the team so strong and the TA so valuable, that we really have. We always say, if you don't have the expertise, there's somebody here that does. But we just need to look around the room and bring them in.
Yep. AJ said maybe verbatim on that same line, not just an hour ago.
Yeah.
I think it's fun, too. We have in a good spirited way, competitive bunch, like really the care and are committed. You could look no further, honestly, than our walking challenge, step challenge team that we have. You should look when they have all the results. It's wild with some of the folk. We have Jenna and Craig and Robert and Sue. Robert's texting me in 20,000 step days from his honeymoon. Craig's going on like 6-hour bike rides, and Jenna's doing 30,000 step days on the weekends. So it's fun to get that aspect to it as well. Like,
I was thinking you were going to share the example of the competitive nature of how bad a dad joke they could share during the team meeting, because that seems to have become a competition as well.
I was actually thinking that on Monday, that there's certain aspects of teams. I think you see it, the World Series just wrapped up, like weird stuff they do in the dugout, but it doesn't make any sense. And it's not necessarily superstitious, but it's just a part of what they do. Like they wear something if they hit a home run or a certain kind of high five. And I feel like awful dad jokes have become this like unspoken language of connection for our team.
It's a bonding experience.
Flannel shirts.
Yeah. Yes, flannel shirts. Yes. And the other thing that I would be sad if I didn't mention is that we have all of these technical experts that are leading minds in their field, as we've talked about, but none of the TA could be delivered without our operations team and our project managers. And they really are at the cutting edge of their professions as well. They are bringing solutions about how to manage when you have this large of a project and this many grantees, and you've been producing information and resources for we're in our sixth year now. That's a lot to manage. And we need to constantly be refining our approach and looking at our processes and identifying new systems to help us manage. And our project managers are fantastic. Our operations team have vast experience doing that. And they really make sure that everything is delivered seamlessly. So without them, none of the TA would actually get out to the
Absolutely. Shout out to Pops.
Yeah. And I think just to add to what we were talking about with the competitiveness, I would say that that's part of our team, is that if I don't know the answer, I want to find out and I want to get it back to the grantee. So we're going to find out. And we have not only our own technical expert leads, we have the HRSA project officers who have their own expertise. We have our partners like the Centers of Excellence and the other partners that we use and consultants. And then I also want to mention that 5 years into this, just the grantees and their own expertise, and which is really the important point about connecting grantees. And I thought about the last reverse site visit we did in July, where we did 21 breakout sessions, and over 60% of those, we had grantees up on the podium. We had grantees presenting. And in a mature project like this, I think you rely on that expertise too, where the grantees are talking to each other and they figured something out. So I would be remiss if I didn't mention that. Yeah, I think the theme is, if I don't know the answer, I'm going to find out. And there's a team of people, and I don't have to have all the answers, but yeah, somebody has the answer. And how quick can we get back to it? And the quality of the resources is there when we do get back to the grantee.
Yeah. And it really does. I remember when I had grants a couple of years ago, I was fairly new, and I think I came to you with a question. You're like, "Oh, just ask the TELS; you'll get answers back." And I was like, "I don't believe you, but I'm going to try it anyway." And it was, oh my gosh, the amount of responses back. It was like it put together like a thesis on the amount of resources. So you're right; that was pretty spot on, John. With the RSV, I think it's a really interesting experience. And I was thinking back to, I guess it was just 4 months ago now, but there's a couple things that stood out to me there, which will be our segue for the final question around anything that has been a particularly impactful memory or anything noteworthy that kind of stands out throughout both your times with ArtCore. And for me, at the RSV, when all the folks who'd never been to DC before, or their first time at the RSV, raised their hand. I thought that was really cool because everyone's, you know, operating not in a bubble, but they're doing their own work in their different service areas. And then they do have the shared ArcCore identity, which might, you know, be come alive a little bit on peer-to-peer calls and things like that. But in person, it's pretty strong. And I think that was cool. They could connect and talk in between sessions and at lunch. And we had our recovery meeting. And that was like another layer to it as well, where there's folks there sharing how great the event's been, but also how heard and seen they felt by having space to put on their other hat. Because they're like, yeah, I work in this field and I'm part of ArcCore, but also I'm in recovery and I need to talk about this stuff too. For me, that's what stood out. But anything that comes to mind for you, John?
First, it was great to be back with everybody. I know the last time we had all been together was 2020, March 3rd through 6th, which was 2 days before the COVID restrictions kicked in. So we got everybody home safely from that RSV and then didn't see everybody again together until this July. For me, that it's a wonderful memory. I just love that. I agree with you. I love the energy of it. And I like that in response to grantee comments over the past RSVs where they've requested time for networking and time to talk to each other and time to do things like you mentioned, the affinity groups where people can get together in a more informal setting, that they wanted that to be a part of the RSV. And I think we provided that. And it was just, to me, that's just great when everybody get together. And it's great to see everybody. Starting as a talent on ArcCore, I've known some of these grantees for coming up on 6 years now, where we used to talk at least once a month and more if we were doing TA. And so I feel like it's almost like bringing people over to your house when you have people come to the RSV. And we want it to go right. We want people to get what they need out of it, but also have a great experience in addition to increasing their knowledge, where because it can be lonely when I've worked in rural communities. I live in a rural community. When you go back home and that you have to keep that energy somehow where you're like, there's thousands of people across the country doing exactly what I'm doing. And it can feel isolating, but to get together and get that kick to it when you go back in your community and say, other people are figuring this out and I'm going to figure it out too, I think is that's a key piece for me.
Yeah, spot on. And Alicia.
Yeah, I don't want to just say ditto because, of course, the RSV is, it's just so great just because the numbers of people, right, that are there sharing their experience is so powerful. But I would say that my other favorite experiences have been when I've had an opportunity to go on site and do a site visit because there's nothing like actually being in the community, going to the pizza place with a consortium members and getting to meet the folks that you're hearing about every month on the calls, but you actually get to meet them and talk with them and see what they're talking about. And I think the relationship is so strengthened. The understanding is much greater and deeper when we're able to go on site. And so I just love that. I remember the very first year, the Planning One cohort, there was a grantee that was struggling a little bit. They'd had a lot of turnover in their project director position, and they just had a hard time finding the right fit. And by spring, they were pretty frustrated, and they had a new person in the position. He'd only been in for about a week. And so I went out, and I just sat down with her at her desk for a day, and we just walked through their work plan and talked about where to start and how to get going. And it was just so great. And I still touch base with her and chat with her occasionally because it was such a great, just such a great experience. So love that.
That was Alicia Figueroa and John Roberts sharing a bit of their insight on ArcCore TA's past and present. Like I said, I'll sound like a broken record, but it's a remarkable program. Some of the history is incredible. In a relatively short amount of time, some of the information that you might remember hearing at the RSV this past summer as we celebrated 5 years is that in the beginning, there was just 95 grantees right at the start. As I mentioned earlier in the episode, we're now at nearly 400 currently. Over 4,000 rural agencies have joined to create sustainable partnerships, an increase of 272% since ArcCore first began. ArcCore consortia have trained over 600,000 staff, volunteers, and community members, and more than 5,700 service delivery sites are currently addressing SUD and OUD in rural communities. This is a big number. Over 4 million rural residents have accessed a diverse array of screening, diagnostic, and treatment services over the course of the year, an 18-fold increase since our core began. Those are just some of the numbers that kind of put into perspective what you all have been able to do over the course of time that our core has been around. Next up, we're going to hear from one of the original our core grantees.
We're joined now by one of the very first our core grantees, the Michigan Center for Rural Health, and we have the pleasure of having Joyce Fetro, John Barnes, and Laura Zing on. Thank you all so much for making the time to come out and chat with us today. I'm hoping we can just start with your different roles within the project. Joyce, would you like to start?
Sure. I started volunteering during the planning grant phase back in 2018, and throughout that process, John had approached me and said, if we get awarded implementation, this might, you know, turn into some staffing opportunities. And I think actually he asked me to write one of the job descriptions, which I did so creatively as to exclude anyone else from being able to apply for the position for a project associate. So
strategic.
Yeah, strategically I did. And so I started as a project associate supporting, you know, all aspects of the grants. And it was about a year and a half later that our current director at that time had left for personal reasons. And going through that process in itself of replacing her as director was quite painful. And I didn't even consider myself the time for the position. But after some conversations with John, I ended up applying and then accepting the position. So today I'm the project director leading this group.
Perfect. Thanks, Joyce. And John?
Yeah, I'm John Barnes, and I'm the executive director for the Michigan Center for Rural Health. And one of the grants that we manage is the ARCOR grants. We've been very fortunate to have received planning implementations 1 through 4. Psycho-STEM and behavioral health. So we're just very blessed to have a fantastic grant writer on our staff, and we continue to move the project forward, which we've titled the Northern Michigan Opioid Response Consortium. So they have their own office in a United Way building in Gaylord, Michigan, right in the middle of the footprints of the 29 counties we're now in.
Wonderful. Thank you, John. And then over to you, Laura.
All right. And I am Laura Zing. And actually, I've been with, as John said, we shorten it and we call it NMORC, but with the project since the beginning phases, but really just as a partner from a rural hospital. And then from there, myself and our CEO, we were really excited about it. And I ended up becoming the board chair of the board of directors, which has been just an absolute pleasure to see the work done. Certainly day-to-day operations, that's Joyce, John, some other people, a huge team, that wonderful team that Joyce works with. I'm a little bit higher level, just looking at it from a little bit different angle, because my day-to-day job is working at Kalkaska Memorial Health Center, where I'm a vice president in administration. But I worked under chronic disease and behavioral health, and there was just a lot of ties of what I was doing in a rural community with a lot of the issues that we're going to be talking about. It just made a lot of sense for me to be a part of that group. And like I said, it's just been an absolute pleasure to work with this group and an absolute honor to be on the board of directors.
Definitely. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Laura. And again, appreciate the three of you making the time to join. It feels special to have kind of one of the original ARCOR grantees on, as this episode is looking at ARCOR over the past 5 years, the past year, looking ahead in our, you know, finale for this kind of first season. John, you counted out those 7 different ARCOR awards over time, and I think you mentioned 5 currently. Maybe this question is for you to start, but could you just give an overview a little bit of some of the work you've been able to accomplish within the state over those past 5 years?
Sure. But all started with planning. And when we heard there was going to be a planning grant for ARCOR, I think it was $200,000. We went up north. We had invited people to meet with us. I believe it was in the city of Roscommon, a very small rural community, ends up being in the epicenter of the OUD, SUD issues in northeast section of the Lower Peninsula. And we invited hospitals, FQHCs, local public health, community mental health, treatment providers. And they all showed up. We had probably 30 people in this meeting, and we talked about it, and we knew the RFP was going to be released. And I remember saying, everyone put their finger up in the air, or their pointer finger, and said, if you think we should go for the grant, went to the center to write it. All 30 fingers pointed at us. And so we took that and we ran with it. We used a methodology of creating committees to work on prevention, workforce recovery, and treatment. And I think it was at the second meeting, we were meeting on a monthly basis, going up to Grayling. And Joyce said, you ever thought about inviting people with lived experience to be part of these committees? No, but that's really a brilliant idea. So she rounded up a bunch of folks and they started meeting with us. And what they were able to teach us is, I think the saying is, not for us, without us. And we would not be where we are without the people in recovery and treatment guiding us through this. We started off with a planning grant, and as I mentioned, we've been very successful in expanding the footprint from the original 16 counties to 29. And it doesn't happen without Joyce's leadership as a project director, and then also Laura as the NMORC ward chair. We started off, we know that there at some point in time, the funding will diminish or cease. And so one of the first things we did for sustainability was make NMORC a nonprofit. They have their own 501c3 status, and Laura is the board chair for NMORC. We continue to write grants to fund it, and we have, I think, touched many lives. Joyce's crew, we now have two project associates and a contracted medical director who is a former CMO at Munson Healthcare System, Dr. David McGram, and he's been instrumental. There's nothing quite like peer-to-peer discussion. If the four of us were ever to go in and try and talk to physicians about OUD and SUD issues, we don't get past the front door, right? But if you're a doctor, you betcha, because that's street credibility. We've continued to grow. We've moved into the behavioral health realm, having Munson and My Michigan Health, which are on opposite sides of I-75, and they are completely cooperating as two systems to increase behavioral health access to the OUD-SUD population. And we've also been very successful working with Dr. Robin Morrow on the psychostim side of things, too. I will stop there. That's a little history. In the weed stuff, that's for Joyce and Laura to talk about. I'm not that smart of a guy. I just know talent and hiring. There you go.
Hey, that's perfectly fine. You packed a lot in there. I'm actually going to pivot to a couple things from there, but I just want to see Joyce or Laura, if you have anything you wanted to add in, building off what John was just talking about.
I was just going to add, I think, and John really said it, but the growth has just been incredible. I truly remember the first meeting and those 30 people and putting their finger there and saying, yeah, let's go for the 200,000. And now what we've grown to, and I don't know, Joyce or John, if you remember, it was just a handful of counties we started with. And now it's up to 29. It's just incredible to see the growth and to see. And every single time we've gone to the board of directors, we've gone to the consortium, we've gone to the group, we've gone to Joyce's team and said, what do you guys think about expanding into other counties? I don't think there's ever been any hesitation. It's truly one of those, the more the merrier. I told myself, don't bring up the C word, COVID, with pandemic, but this is truly our other pandemic. So to be able to see the growth that we've had and over the last few years is just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I would say that the biggest function of NMORC is collaboration. And I know when I first started, I didn't realize that there was so much competition between the healthcare organizations within each other. And I'm like, they do have customers, and it's no different than any other retail store. But I think now, today, we really work fluidly together. They share ideas, they share processes, they share programming that's been implemented. And people want that. If one organization's doing it, the other ones aren't too far behind from implementing it themselves. And what I'm talking about is things like Project Assert, having recovery coaches in the emergency department. We only had to start that with one healthcare system, and it just continues to spiral and grow from there.
Joyce, you were talking about a little bit before we started recording, and John mentioned it too, nothing about us without us, and the importance of involving those with lived experience. What did you experience where you thought that was a priority, and how did that kind of come about?
As a woman in long-term recovery myself, like I said in the very beginning during that planning phase, the survey questions from the needs assessment didn't seem to connect with what I knew of the recovery community. And their barriers to treatment were not what was up on the board that day. They faced transportation barriers, facing losing their children, things like that. And I just thought that it would be beneficial for the group as a whole to reel in the recovery community into this think tank group and planning process. They would let us know what all the barriers were. And I only had the scope of a few counties on my own mind. But we said, as we expanded into 25 additional counties, we continued to learn that there's definitely some desert areas for treatment, recovery, and even prevention. We didn't have some of those systems in place where we do today.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. As you know, one of the grantees that has been funded since really the inception of ARCOR, anything you can talk about on how you've seen the larger kind of ARCOR umbrella program grow over the years, and for anybody?
John, do you want to take that one, or you want me to?
I was going to say.
Go ahead, Joyce.
I would just say that we've continued to add in partners that we've learned from. Harm Reduction Michigan provides harm reduction services, and that was a new process for even me to learn as a person in recovery. And I can only know that it was a process for others to learn as well. We knew treatment, we knew about recovery, and we knew prevention, but the stigma that exists with even harm reduction practices, and then having others continue to even implement those at local public health. Within the Michigan State Police program has a harm reduction program where they call it the Angel Program, where someone can surrender themselves. So every single partner that we have today, I think, has some program, big or small, to one way or another to address this issue of substance use.
Great. Yeah, that's always wonderful to hear. With the different kind of ARCOR events over the years, Laura brought up COVID and obviously that first RSV in March 2020 happened right as everything was happening. And then there's this 2.5 year break before everyone's in person again. But what's been the experience like for those who have been able to attend any of the RSV or other ARCOR events over that time, the different connection opportunities and everything else that happens? Could anyone chime in on what that
experience has been? Yeah, let me take my first swing at that, guys. One thing that we've gone to the Riverside visit, and I've been approached by a few people who on the federal level and on the state level too, and what they're just amazed is that when we started our project and we have quarterly consortium meetings, and so everyone has, they drive to Grayling, and I think they drive to the taco bar too that's at the end of the meeting because it's really good.
Absolutely.
And they haven't stopped. And as we've added more counties and organizations and community-based organizations to the consortium, no one has stopped attending. There's always 30 to 45 people who always attend. Now we have the hybrid method because COVID forced us into doing things on Zoom and Teams, and we still offer it. But and even then, they still will still have 30 to 45 people on a quarterly basis total, either in person in Grayling at Kirtland Community College or Zooming in to the meeting too. It hasn't stopped. The commitment of all of the organizations, hospitals, FQHCs, treatment centers, all of them, they all just stop what they're doing on the second Friday of the month from 9 to 12. And there's educational sessions, and there's networking, and there's report outs on committee work, and of course, report outs by Joyce and her two project associates. So that is one of the most interesting and valuable lessons we've learned is if you can convene people around a subject that they fully believe in, then they will continue to meet and address the issue. And tacos help too.
That's what I was going to ask. I was going to say, how do you feel like you build up to that level of consortium engagement? Was it, is it the world's best taco bar? Are there other pieces to the puzzle that go into it? Because that's impressive to get that level of consistent engagement over
the- I'll turn it over to Joyce, but it's her and Laura being able to lead the group, and then they're coming in. So go ahead, guys.
I would say that we always bring in at least one or two speakers to provide an educational topic, as well as the lived experience stories that kick off the beginning of the meeting. This next Friday, we have someone coming from EMS at the state level for through MDHHS, Anthony Pantaleo, who will share the updates on the naloxone leave behind and how they're implementing naloxone on in different ways and saving lives. The other one is about a social worker in Grand Traverse County that works within the jail system to identify those that have substance use. And instead of having them incarcerated, let's get them, you know, started on a treatment plan, whether it's they can leave incarceration and start that, or there's a plan for after incarceration when they can begin that treatment process. But there's a system in place to address the issue. And when we have law enforcement on board, that's huge. And one of our biggest cheerleaders is on our board as well. And he's with the Michigan State Police. Excellent guy. And we need him. We need that peer-to-peer relationship with other law enforcement to see him, you know, in that space doing some great work in promoting what we do.
Yeah, as I had mentioned, I really see this truly as our other pandemic, as the other COVID certainly has winded down, that this is the pandemic facing our nation today and certainly before. But I think because of that, and I think the momentum that we even had going into it, and it's unbelievable working in a small hospital, and I do a lot of event outreach. I do a lot of marketing for our hospital. I do a lot of awareness. And things came to a screeching halt. This was probably the one program, the one thing that I did that never came to a screeching halt. That the momentum kept going. It was so important to people, and we had so much going on that I think the creativity with Joyce said that we did meet virtually for a while, and now we still offer a hybrid format, but people weren't stopping. They weren't saying, you know what, because of COVID, I'm going to stop working on this. And then I think that's a great point is when you do come in person, I always make a point. I can't always, but I try really hard to come in person. Because it does bring that group together. And like Joyce said, one of our biggest cheerleaders, whether you're doing anything, if you're going 2 miles over the speed limit, it can be intimidating to have this day of the state police. And he is the most approachable person and so kind. And it is so neat to have him there for people to talk to have him to be a cheerleader, to have him be part of our group. So I think that really to be able to have so many cross sections of backgrounds and people, and those people with lived experience, that we just didn't want the momentum to stop, that we weren't going to let, truly, we weren't going to let COVID get in our way. We were going to be safe about it, but we weren't going to let it get in our way. And I just don't think the momentum stopped, and it was really neat to see it keep going.
Yeah, it sounds like you all have capitalized on the momentum to plant deep roots in so many different places and keep that momentum going, and also, you know, build a strong base to be able to weather the different things that come up. So that's great. Twofold kind of question, any particularly impactful or standout memory over the years, whether it's with ARCOR, maybe there's something at the RSV or something on a monthly call, or within the work you all are doing within the state that kind of stands out or maybe made you stop and just reflect, or an inflection point, anything like that?
Two to share. One of them was, like I had mentioned in the very beginning, during 2018, we only had, you know, two or three recovery houses. Today we had 15. I know personally what a fight it was at the county level to get to implement a recovery house. And often we had to find locations outside of city limits, as I know other operators have. But today, with the opioid settlement dollars coming down, we have counties now funding recovery houses. It's just been that overall, you know, shift in looking at it in a different light and realizing that this is a human issue, not necessarily a moral issue. These are our neighbors, our coworkers in each of our communities that we need to support. We ran into issues of not wanting those people in our communities and getting them to recognize that those people do live in their communities already. We're trying to implement safe housing for them. another one that we still, I would say there's still some stigma with, is medically assisted treatment, clinics and providers. And that we had a portion of law enforcement that was highly against medically assisted treatment clinics. And there was a time when they were targeting individuals leaving that clinic, giving them field sobriety tests on the side of the road, to the point where that person was so nervous that they would fail and then receive an operating while intoxicated charge, a criminal charge. But years down the road, after doing all of this work, we had an issue where a gentleman who lived about 55 miles away from the clinic, his ride fell through. We know transportation is a barrier, but his ride fell through and he made the decision to drive to the clinic. And he had to, one, out of survival, and two, out of not going through withdrawals. Because if he didn't make it there, it was going to be a tough, painful day for him. And en route, he gets pulled over on the side of the highway and he pleads with the law enforcement officer. And he says, if I don't make it to this clinic, I know I'm driving without a license, but if I don't make it to this clinic, I'm going to be in withdrawals by tomorrow. It's just going to be a bad situation for me. And the officer said, I don't know what to tell you, buddy. I can't let you drive, but let me take you there. And he put him in the vehicle and he drove him the rest of the way to the clinic. Afterwards, they made arrangements for his vehicle to get back to wherever it needed to go. And he didn't give him a criminal charge and he took care of him. And that's one of our biggest success stories I think we have to date, where you see a shift in law enforcement who is normally out to write a ticket, put another notch, you know, in their belt. But he just had this other caring, compassionate side to him. And he wasn't an officer that was already engaged with the MWRC process. This is just an officer that probably learned from another one that, look, there's a shift going on and a change. We need to embrace these people in the community.
Yeah. How powerful.
Yeah.
We need more of those kind of stories. It reminds me, actually, and I haven't got pulled over in a while, but when the last time it was here in Delaware, and I had just come back from a late candlelight meeting and I had 60 days and I think I got my key tag at that meeting.
Yeah,
and I got pulled over. I don't know where this cop was hiding, and I didn't even think I was speeding that much, but I got pulled over. And he said, "Where are you coming from?" And I was like, "Seriously, I'm coming from a 12-step meeting. Like, here's the key tag." And he looked at it, and he was just like nodded and just walked. He said, "Have a good night."
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, "Oh my gosh,
incredible."
Yeah, like universe saying, "Keep going." So hopefully, more instances of that over time. John or Laura, anything you wanted to add to that piece around any standout memories or stats, anything along those lines?
I don't think any stats, just a couple things that kind of, I had to think for a second.
Yeah.
Devin, when Joyce said yes to being the program director, that's a highlight. Even before that, Dr. David McGramp said, yep, I'll be the contracted medical director. I was like, yes, that was a really good day. Yeah, the passion of the local public health officers. Laura's boss, Kevin Rogels, attending all those early meetings and be right up front and saying, this is what we can do at Kalkaska to help everybody out. And then I guess one last one would be the first time I met Sue Winter over at the Northern Michigan Substance Abuse Services. It's a treatment center. And Mike McNeely was in town. He was coming to our first, he's with the Federal Office for Health Policy. At that point in time, I think he was managing the ARCOR section of things. And he came in for our first OUD-SUD summit as a keynote speaker. Came in early and we took him on a little road trip. And one of the places we went to was NEMSAS. Sue had agreed to give Mike and a few of us a tour. I'd never been there. And I walked away with so much hope for the project area and the project, because what the passion and love Sue has for her job and the people coming through the doors was just palatable. It blew us away. Kudos to all those people who helped us out and continue to work on the NWRC project.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Then final question, similar to the last one, but more so looking ahead instead of reflecting back. Any hopes on where your work can expand? And then in the same kind of vein, any hopes for ARCOR looking ahead as well? So either place, either the stuff you all are working on within the state or the kind of ARCOR program overall. Joyce, do you want to start?
Yeah, I would say if there's the opportunity for R-Corp funding, I would only bet that we would apply. I don't see us expanding so much past the 25 counties. What we have is quite large already. It's over a third of the state. But we've learned so much that I think it's time to go back and implement some of those things that we've learned along the way to improve other practices within recovery courts and healthcare, local public health, like all entities, schools. We didn't leave a sector in the communities untouched, but we've learned so much along the way that we need to go back and just reevaluate where we are today and look how we can just improve those practices that we already have in place or strengthen them.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks, Joyce. John or Laura, anything to add as we close things out?
Yeah, this goes a little bit, I think, with the last question. This might seem a little more minute, but I don't think it's any less impactful. As I think back to some of the small things we did in the beginning that we've expanded, including just some of our equipment, some of our scholarships, some of the money we've spent from our medication disposal kiosks. I think about, again, a lot of my viewpoint comes from a small rural hospital, but when this program started is actually when we were convinced that for a while, oh, there's one of those boxes a block down the road at the local police station. We don't need one at the hospital. Becoming part of this group and learning how important they are, we put one in, and I don't have the statistic in front of me, but for the size of our hospital, for the size of our community, we had some of the highest in weight and in volume disposable medications of any of the counties. It was absolutely incredible, and it continues to be that way. And I think that also goes hand in hand. And we've mentioned our medical director, Dr. McGram, who's absolutely incredible, who's gone in and been able to convince schools, libraries, commissions on aging. The list is just endless to have the naloxone kit. So you have your fire extinguisher, you might have your AED, and then on top, you have those naloxone kits. 5 years ago, that didn't exist. And I think without this group, without the passion, and like John said, the three of us going in might not be able to convince them, but with Dr. McGram and his knowledge and his passion going in, we went from at least what I know and even our hospital to our community having none of that to just incredible numbers. Actually, we saw a map not that long ago, and we actually think it was a little bit inaccurate because we think it was a lot more than what the map showed of all the different locations where these resources are available. So I continue to see that to grow. And one of the things I think will continue to grow is really looking at our school. So where does this start? And I think it really starts at a young age, at a younger age. And again, I know there's a lot of different viewpoints about that. Some people very much agree with us. Some people do not. But we actually here in Kalkaska have an adolescent program. And we have found whether it's smoking cessation, whether it is drugs, whether it's bullying, that it's starting at that young age and what a difference it makes as they grow up and they're working with their parents and they're having those conversations. I really would love to continue to see us helping with the funding that we do have, continue to put those naloxone kits and those medication kiosks in different locations and also working with that younger population.
Thanks, Laura. Yeah, that piece you shared, what a good testament to the impact overall of this project to have that kind of domino effect of bits of change for good throughout all these different counties and organizations within the state. But final word.
Sure. We so value our partnership and relationship with the Federal Office for Health Policy. It's a great organization. And coming up with the entire concept of R-Corp and funding communities at a local level, how we got it, and I think I'm really proud of how we've been able to expand across the one-third of the Lower Peninsula, you know, from N55 to the bridge. And it's a testament to the work that the consortium's doing and the staff. Funding, well, sustainability, right? We have to find a way to sustain what we're doing. And I'm an advocate that this program should be set up a lot like the FLEX program or the state office program, where it's a 5-year grant program, where me and the grant writing staff here, Crystal and others, don't have to write an annual grant, where we, if it's a 5-year grant, like FLEX, Medicare Rural Hospital Flexibility Program, Critical Access Hospital, then we can put together a work plan, have our set funding, and then come back to it every 5 years, not every year, and look for ways to continue a revenue stream. Other than that, we'll just continue to look at grants, looking at different foundations, but it's we're looking at it now. You have to think about it, but we're not in danger of shutting down at all. We have a few years of funding left. I just really appreciate this opportunity, Tim. I think what with Laura's leadership on the NMORC board and Joyce's leadership as the project director for NMORC and all the consortium members, it's a great project. It's a great success story.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's an impressive body of work. And obviously the different key individuals that have come together to put it all into motion over time and build that up. It's really remarkable and a great testament to ArcCorp overall and what it's able to help communities do throughout the country. So again, appreciate all three of you making the time to come out and share a little bit about what you're doing with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
That's all for our season one finale of Rural Roads, the ArcCorp podcast. I'm your host, Tim Raybould, thanking you for tuning in throughout all of 2023. We hope you have a happy holidays and take good care. We'll see you next time.